really a great pleasure to have the opportunity again to introduce Rabbi Angel. Just one comment on 3 hours or so about wisdom svarim of Tanakh. It's like somehow you're supposed to pack in all the wisdom of one set of Tanakh into 1 hour, but you've done a masterful job of trying to at least help us understand how much more wisdom there is in each sefer. And really that, I'm sure, is the main goal. And we really appreciate you taking the time to come here and prepare the shiurim, which some prepared, I guess, for us, especially Mishlei, but the others, someone actually mentioned to me that they had asked someone if they were going to come tonight to hear Kohelet, and they said no because they took your whole course. So they assumed that they probably learned more in the course than they would learn this evening. So the courses are available probably on the internet, although they're not the same as the person. We'd like to thank the sponsors of this evening, Health and Sandler, in memory of Health, parents, San Elizabeth Philly, Yoshua Ben Holovazi, and Bela Bastain Eliezer, and the Appel family, in memory of Dr. Anna and Rabbi Chaim Grossman, Rabbi Chaim Zev Ben Rudmeyer, and Rabbi Shengel Bashab Zev. We thank them for sponsoring this evening. Also, just the recognition we had the sponsors here earlier week, Michael Neal Schreiber, in memory of Michael's father, and John and Marion Yosef Kramer, in memory of Marion's father, and these course all of those neshamos, and a reminder also that although we're taking a break for a few weeks from Tanakh, and we'll come back on November 17th for a special pre-Hanukkah lecture on the Book of Maccabees and Rabbinic Thought. The Book of Maccabees is not a Book of Tanakh, in case you weren't sure. Getting to the roots of Hanukkah, and I'm sure Rabbi Angel, even though he's an expert in Tanakh, also has what to say about the Book of Maccabees, and I guess why it didn't get into Tanakh. And we thank the sponsor of that, Avraham Yisrael Blumenthal, in memory of Avraham's father and Avraham's grandfather. And I take the opportunity also for a little commercial from our sponsor. Our sponsor is the shul, as we know. We depend on the shul. I know one of the rabbi's roles is not necessarily fundraising, nor is it one of the Rebbe's roles fundraising, although the Rebbe somehow seems to do a lot of fundraising. And as you might have heard, there's a clothing sale next Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday. And there is a volunteer chart to sign up, and we need you. So please, before you leave, pick a slot. There's one at the back table, there's one over here. Pick a slot and sign up. You can pick actually 7 slots if you like. But please try to pick 1 slot. We thank you very much. And without further ado, Rabbi Angel, thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi Hochberg. Thank you all again for coming. You know, I'm sure that in some points in school they're supposed to give you a class on, you know, you're supposed to make a good first impression. Somehow I was sick that day or cut class. I don't know what it is. I actually tried to rig this series that I kept getting better. So at least in my perception of it, Mishlei, which I love, and we discussed its contribution to Tanakh. Then you have Iyov, which somehow challenges one of the most important axioms. And then there's Kohelet. I'm a big fan of Kohelet. I'm very grateful that it's there and that Chazal did include it in Tanakh. But it's a really, really hard book to learn. Rabbi Hochberg mentioned the course, which you cannot find online, actually. You had to be there. But in the meantime, but hopefully, yes, I hope that they covered more ground in a nine-week series of shiurim than in a one-hour thing. The point of a one-hour shiur is always to try to boil it down and to open up avenues for further thought. I think that's also the point of a 9-week course, but all the more so for a one hour shiur. Kohelet fascinated me from the very beginning when I tried to learn it in order to teach it, because when you go through the parshanut, you see something very strange, and you see it repeatedly. Our mifarshim are two things. They're always two things. One is they're scholars. They're truly outstanding, exceptional scholars who continue to guide us year in, year out, for century in, century out. It's amazing what they're able to do. When you're a true scholar, you theoretically have no personality. And I mean that in the best possible way. What does it mean you have no personality? It means you have to shut yourself down, and the text that you're trying to interpret is everything. And you have to hear the voice of the text the best that you possibly can, figure out what it means, and that's great scholarship. So that's one element of what every parshan is, and that's what makes them so great and why their works continue to guide us on that level. At least from a religious point of view, every parshan is a second thing, and that is you're a religious guide. You know that what you're writing about and what you're interpreting is going to guide your life, because what you think pshat is, you think this is what prophecy says, that changes you forever, And you're hoping that somebody else might actually read your Perush. Ideally a lot of people. And you're hoping that they too will be influenced by your reading of the text, and that they too will be guided religiously. In most Sfarim, there's not such a huge gap between those two goals. Great scholarship is great religious guidance. When you get around to Kohelet, you suddenly see an incredible amount of discomfort with the book. Incredible. What I wanted to do tonight very briefly is outline some of the halachic parameters of why there's so much discomfort, some of the strategies that some of our mifarshim use, and if you actually are committed to pshat, what you might want to try to do instead. We'll start with a couple of sources that are not directly pertinent to Kohelet, but they get us right into the framework of where we need to be. Source number one over here talks about the hazards of religious learning. Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachman b'shem Rabbi Yonatan Amar. B'sha'ah she'haya Moshe kotev et ha-Torah. God is telling Moshe Rabbeinu what to write in the Torah, and he writes it down. Haya kotev ma'aseh kol yom b'yom. So Moshe Rabbeinu is writing down, I always do this. I'm a lefty, and therefore I just do this. But of course, Moshe Rabbeinu was writing. So I'm going to continue this. He probably was born left-handed, but they made him right-handed. But in the meantime, I'm sure that when he was writing the Torah, he actually was using his right hand. Let us make man in our image and form. Amar lefanav. Ribono ha'olam. Ma tam noten pikvon kol aminim. God, do you really... Moshe Rabbeinu puts down his pen, his quill, whatever he's using over there, and he says, God, you know, before I write this into the Torah, I have a question. Do you really want to use plural-sounding forms here? It's a really bad idea. After all, there are all kinds of heretical groups. There are all kinds of people who will use this as a proof text that there's some plurality within the Godhead. There's no question that this midrash is at least in part thinking about Christianity and using all of these plural type forms to try to prove the Trinitarian theory or belief, whatever you want to call it. Sadia Gaon on that pasuk mentions that explicitly, that Christians would appeal to this exact pasuk and say, oh, you see here that there's some plurality. So this midrash is reflecting that. This midrash is saying, putting in Moshe Rabbeinu's mouth, he looks God in the eye and says, do you really want to do this? It's a bad idea. And God replies, well, first, Moshe Rabbeinu is still here. Et mahe, I don't understand. Now, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Amar lo, tov. Baroteli dotite. God says, Torah is all about truth and integrity. And this, I'm God. I'm writing an absolutely perfect Torah right now. And yes, I realize that there are heretical sects and people with agendas. And you know what? People will always be able to prove their points if they have agendas, no matter what text you give them. I learned this lesson in graduate school when I had to write a history paper on the disputation of Barcelona, where an apostate Pablo Cristiani, who had grown up and, you know, learned, was a good yeshiva boy, who then became a Christian, so he knew Gemara. He was the first person in the whole Jewish-Christian polemic who tried to argue that Chazal believed in Christianity and tried to prove it from Gemarot and Midrashim. So Ramban, who was the rabbi in question, before even getting into the specifics, just says, you know, before we even get to debating the specifics here, you know, if Chazal really believed in Christianity, you know what they would have done? They would have converted. And they would have told all the rest of us to convert too. Well, you see, they didn't. So every single reading in that you're going to try to do is obviously false. Great argument, Ramban. It forced him, of course, to have to flee Spain and move to Israel, because these were not even-handed intellectual polemics at all. But good for Ramban for having the integrity to do that. This midrash is hitting on the objective truth of Torah. God wanted to put things right, knowing that, of course, there will always be people who will have crazy agendas and will read those agendas right into the Torah. God cannot worry about them. So that's a vote for integrity. And it's about this pasuk in question, Na'aseh Adam Mitalmenu Kidmutenu. You go to source number two. The very first time the Torah ever was translated into another language was in the time of Ptolemy, the so-called Septuagint, translation into Greek. So the Talmud is a wonderful story about this. The Tanya, Ma'aseh b'Talmai ha-melech shechineh 72 zekenim. Ptolemy got 72 different elders, 72 rabbis. V'chnitzam b'shivim u'shnayim batim, and he put them in 72 different soundproof rooms. Lo gilal hem ad mashek kinyusan. Now go in here. I'm going to lock you in this room. I'm not going to tell you what it's all about. Now he goes door to door and tells each one what the mission is. Please write to me in Greek the whole Torah. God inspired these 72 rabbis. And all 72 rabbis agreed. Rav Yitzchak Huttner argued that it would have been even a bigger miracle if 72 rabbis sat in the same room and agreed. But in the meantime, it's a miracle all the same that all 72 came up with the same translation. Elokim bara bereshit. They didn't write bereshit bara Elokim because you and I know that means something to the effect of in the beginning God created. But if you don't know better, it might sound like some deity named bereshit created Elokim, which if you are a pagan and believe in pagan mythology, that's exactly what you might expect to see here. So to avoid that ambiguity, they wrote Elokim bara bereshit. God created bereshit, so that way there's no ambiguity. It's very clear that Elokim is the deity and bereshit is not. And what else did they change? All 72 rabbis translating the Torah into Greek eliminated the plural form and put it in the singular. Now, does this Gemara contradict the first source where God is very emphatic? I want it to sound plural because that's the right way to do it. But yet these rabbis, inspired by God, are changing it to the singular form. I don't think there's any contradiction at all. There could be. But I don't think that there is one in this particular case. One is talking about the objective integrity of the Torah. When God wrote the Torah and revealed it, it had to be pristine. God can't start being a polemicist. But when it comes to translation for public consumption, or in this case for non-Jewish consumption, well then, you do care about what other people think. And you do care about the impressions that you might make. And in this case, God cared through this Gemara, through the rabbis, to make sure that there were no misperceptions of what the Torah was trying to teach. There's a third category of people. So far we're just talking about heretics or people with agendas. We can't worry about them. Then we have people who are non-Jews who should at least walk away with the import of what the Torah is. How about Jews in synagogues? There are all these public readings that we do where the rabbi doesn't always have the opportunity to explain every single thing in a single year's worth of sermons or classes. He always tries. Rabbis are superheroes. But they can't always explain everything every time. The services would get pretty long. So you keep going and going and going, and over many years you hope to get through many issues. But what happens if you read things that might lead sincere Jews astray? Well, the Talmud is worried about that in Megillah Kaf Hei Amud Aleph. It's not in your source sheet. But they actually enumerate several passages that Chazal feel should either, in the case of the Torah, you have to read the whole Torah. There's no way out. But, you know, in the good old days, they used to translate everything. So there would be a reader who would read it in Hebrew, and then a translator who would say it in Aramaic. Why did they say it in Aramaic? Because there was no art scroll. Right? I mean, you needed somebody who was going to explain in the vernacular. This is what most people understood. So Chazal ruled that there are certain verses that you're not allowed to translate. Why not? Because you don't want most people to know that these verses are there. You can't delete them from the Torah. The reader has to read them in Hebrew, but that way only the learned elite who understood Hebrew understood that something just happened. Chazal were nervous that during public Torah readings, sincere Jews coming to shul and God bless them, paying attention, right? Paying attention to the Torah reading and trying to understand it, Chazal were afraid that if they tried to understand it in the most sincere, God-fearing way, if they don't have the background, they might walk away with more religious harm than religious good. To avoid that hazard, Chazal say there are certain things that we must not translate, and when it comes to Haftarot, there are certain passages that they ruled were not even allowed to read in Hebrew. So that way only the people who know all of Tanakh know that they're there, whereas most people will simply never know they exist. That's an incredible posture to take, by the way, one that's almost irrelevant today when everything is accessible, bookstores, online, etc. There's nothing you could hide. But in the olden days, Chazal felt that there was a chance of actually censoring from public consumption certain passages because they felt that they would cause more harm than good. And that brings us over to Kohelet. As a whole, there's no book in Tanakh where Chazal felt that there's a chance that sincere-minded people reading Kohelet might walk away from learning it less religious than they were before they read it. That's a problem, because Tanakh is supposed to make you more religious. Right? That's the whole goal. And if it makes you less religious, or if Chazal fear that the entire book might make more people less religious than not, what do we do? It's written by the wisest of all men, Shlomo HaMelech, traditionally, you know, with the nickname Kohelet in our book. But what do you do with that? And we'll talk about why they thought this in just a little while. I'll tell you what they taught me in school. You already know that that means I probably don't think it's correct, and you're surmising correctly. Somewhere for the record, it should be noted, sometimes what they taught us in school was right. But in this case, it's just wildly off the mark. I mean, what I was taught is that Kohelet's message is that this world is irrelevant and everything is Torah. Torah is eternal. Torah is eternal. But if you read Kohelet on the shallowest of shallow levels or on the deepest of deep levels, it doesn't say that. In fact, here's a good statistic for you. The word Torah appears in all of Kohelet a grand total of 0 times. So it's pretty incredible to think that the only message that 222 verses have to tell us is the important word in all of this, namely Torah, is simply not there. It's very clear that that is not the message of Kohelet. It's very clear that it's not even one of the messages of Kohelet. So now the question is, well, what is the message of Kohelet? Here's where Chazal get very, very antsy. So antsy that they considered banning the book from Tanakh. Even though it was already there, it was sacred. Nobody doubted its Kedushah. That was never in question. The question was, do we keep it in Tanakh or not? Is it educationally a better idea to remove it or to include it? So I like stuff like this. Now, here's where Chazal are dealing with, it's not just shot in a book anymore. This is religious educational policy. This is the heart and soul of what we're all about as Jews. And we're trying to define what's the best way to educate everybody. Well, the best thing is Tanakh. And then the question is, what should be there? So when people actually, we're busy encouraging people to learn it, what should be there when people actually get inspired and turn to it? And then how do we explain it? We look at source number 3 here, and you see something remarkable. Bikshu chachamim lignoz sefer kohelet. They wanted to, what is geniza? It's to hide. And what sort of stuff do you put in geniza? Sacred things, right? In other words, you wouldn't, if it were useless, you wouldn't have to lignoz it. You could just put it in your shredder. In other words, the issue of lignoz is that Chazal had no question. This is a sacred work. The question is only, should we keep it in Tanakh? Or should we put it into geniza? If somebody in Cairo will find it down the line or whatever. Right? Why did they wish to exclude it? Because there are verses that contradict one another. It's certainly true. There are many contradictions in Kohelet. Why did they not ban it from Tanakh? Because the beginning is from and the end is from. Alright, now let's write this Gemara together for just a minute, because that was hard to follow. It's only 2 lines long, but it was hard to follow. The reason why Chazal were bothered by Kohelet is there are contradictions. Okay, so what should the solution be? What are we about to see here? Let's solve those contradictions. And indeed, in this Gemara, just a few lines after the source that I've given you, they do. They address some of the contradictions. This thing about the beginning is from and the end is from, and therefore, what are they addressing here? If the beginning is from and the end is from, it's kind of like if you go to a wedding and you don't know who's catering, right? So you poke around in the back, or you ask the people at the wedding, and you say, so who's the caterer? Like, look, I don't really know, but I know that the shmorg is glatt kosher and the dessert is glatt kosher, so you may as well just go for the main. Right? Okay, that's not a good standard of kosher for you, but is that what the Gemara is saying? That since the beginning is from and the end is from, therefore, the middle must be okay. But that has nothing to do with contradictions, does it? What does that have to do with? What are they really worrying about here? They're asking a much bigger question. They're asking, is the middle from? Is the middle hashkafically valid and something that we wish to be teaching people? That's what they're asking. It's a much bigger question than contradictions. You could always solve contradictions. We rabbis have been doing this for millennia. Right? We always figure out ways of trying to reckon with psukim that seem to contradict one the other. But this Gemara is asking a far bigger question, and in fact, its answer is remarkable. Namely, since the beginning has some hashkafically valid teaching and the end has some hashkafically valid teaching, we can surmise that the middle must be okay. We see a much more explicit concern coming up in sources 4 and 5. Source 4 is a verse in Kohelet, it's towards the end of the book. The whole sefer is 12 psukim long. Smach bachur b'yalgutecha. O young one, be happy and joyous while you are young. You should go after your heart and your eyes while you are young. But you should know while you're out partying, while you're young, that God is going to judge all of your actions, and therefore, it's a good idea while rejoicing to do it in the right way. Okay, very nice. I'm good with that. I'm sure you're good with that too. That raised a lot of rabbinic eyebrows. And when you look at source number 5, you begin to realize how Chazal read Psukim. Amar Rabbi Binyamin Bar Levi, Bikshu lignoz Sefer Kohelet, Shematu'u bo dvarim shehem notim litzad minut. Why did Chazal want to get rid of Kohelet? Why did they want to lignoz it, to hide it away? Because it might lead people to heresy. This is what was implicit in Shabbat, but it didn't say that, right? In other words, beginning is frum and the end is frum, so that means that the middle must be okay. This midrash is saying explicitly what Chazal are really worrying about. Namely, that they really saw in Kohelet, Psukim, and a whole bunch of them, that very much seemed to go against Torah. And since Torah is the standard, and all the other prophetic books are supposed to uphold the Torah, we got a problem if another biblical book is saying things that are antithetical to Torah. And that's what they're getting nervous about over here. Amru, Tachayara wish lamodomar, smach bachur b'yaldutecha, b'yitchali b'chad b'mebichurotecha. They're picking on the pasuk in source number 4. That's why I quoted it there. Was it really okay for Shlomo, namely Kohelet, to quote, to say, oh, party while you're young? Moshe Amar, Lo Tatsuru, Achare Lochem, Achare Enechem, Asher Atan Zanim Acharehem. Right? We say this all the time. Ushlomo Amar, Tehalef Bidacheli Bechav Mare Enecha. You should go after your heart and your eyes. That seems to be exactly against what Moshe Rabbeinu was cautioning against in the Torah. Ella, Hutra Rutsua, Leitim Beletayan. Oh no! This is against the Torah. It's undermining everything. Kevan she'amar, the daki al kol elei be'achah Elohim ba'mishpat. Ah, then they read Baruch Hashem. They read the second half of that pasuk, where it says that God is going to judge everything. They said Baruch Hashem. Amru yafe amar Shlomo. Now, do you really think Chazal were bothered by this sort of, I mean, like, come on, just read the second half of the pasuk and the problem is solved, which is what they eventually get to. Why have such a terrible anxiety over the first half? And then get over to the second half. The answer is, if you read Midrashim, you understand. This is how Chazal and everybody in their period read Psukim. Yes, they had some semblance of understanding of Pshat. They knew Pshat. That's not how they spoke, and that's not how they taught. Midrashim very often divorced Psukim, or pieces of Psukim, from their natural context. That's just the normal Midrashic way of reading Psukim. So all of a sudden, there is a hazard. People will quote half Psukim, and use that as a religious teaching. And then they will say, oh, Shlomo HaMelech says in Kohelet, we should party while we're young, so that's what we're doing. You can imagine, you know, get this into the hands of enough teenagers, and enough people will quote this very religiously, and the poor teachers and rabbis who are going to try to get them in line are going to have a very difficult day. Okay, so the best solution, by the way, which Chazal finally come around to is, if you have Pshat in the Pasuk, namely if you read it contextually, well, then suddenly it's not a religious problem at all. The Chazal were very, very, very nervous about decontextualized readings, and I will tell you, so were our Mefarshim. Our Pashtanim were still worried about decontextualized readings in Kohelet, because, yes, they weren't likely to read a half Pasuk when the very next half solves it. That wasn't their problem. But you can quote several Pasukim which seem to point in a certain direction, including what Chazal were worried about here, and conclude that that really is what Kohelet is trying to teach. It's no longer just, oh, you just yank a couple words out of context. It's that you really might walk away from Kohelet thinking that that's the message of the book. Party while you're young, since we're all going to die anyway. You could very well read that. Chazal were very deeply worried about that, as were all of the later Mefarshim. And that leads to a very interesting phenomenon. Chazal had at least the theoretical option of banning, or early generations of Chazal had the theoretical option of banning Kohelet. But once they include it, then of course, well, it's sacred literature and it's part of what our religion is. So what do later Mefarshim do? They can't say, oh, we're not going to read this book or we're not going to interpret this book. They have to interpret it also. Mefarshim start using strategies in a very radical way to try to reckon with psukim that make them uncomfortable. Example, source number six over here, excuse me. Ki baruch chokma rav kas. Kohelet says that the more wisdom you have, the angrier or the sadder you get. In English, it's vexation grows, right? Yosif tad, yosif machov. And the more knowledge you have, likewise, the more pain you have, the more heartache. Now, this is the wisest of all men speaking here, and if you read Sefer Mishlei a couple of weeks ago with me, it's very pro-chokmah, right? Chokmah is the best imaginable thing you can go for. It's what our life goals should all be about, and it's very pleasant. Now you read Kohelet saying, you know, basically, you know, ignorance is bliss, and wisdom causes you a lot of pain and heartache. Now, this is a pasuk written by Ruach HaKodesh in a very important discussion about the nature of wisdom and its lasting value. So what do you do with a pasuk like that? Is he trying to say it's better not to have wisdom? The answer to that, just to jump ahead in case you blank out for a minute somewhere along the line, is no, he's not saying that. Wisdom is always great. Okay, but this pasuk was so bothersome to Rav Ovadia Sforno. Great pashtan. But when he got to this pasuk, he couldn't believe it. He said, there's no way that Kohelet is saying that wisdom causes heartache. Because wisdom is a good thing. Wisdom, it brings joy. It brings the greatest. It's all the good stuff. He says, this is referring to the wisdom of heretics. That if you go after heresy, which itself might sound very intelligent, but in fact leads you astray, that brings you heartache and vexation. Now, I don't know, when I read comments like that, I ask myself this question all the time, particularly in Kohelet, where it's just so belated. It's not what the pasuk seems to be saying. Kohelet is describing his personal journey through wisdom and its value and what its lasting value should be. And the logic is that Shlomo HaMelech was the wisest and the wealthiest man ever, or at least the wisest man ever and the wealthiest man of his time. Like the wise part is what matters more, but he was pretty wealthy as well. And he's trying to show that I had it all, and here's what I think of its lasting values and lasting value and consequences, and therefore what should we learn from this? That's his thesis. It wouldn't work if you were poor, because if you start saying, oh, money, who cares? All right, sour grapes, poor guy, but it doesn't even matter. And Midrashim points that out. If you start saying, wisdom, who needs it? Okay, look, if he does bad in school and he starts bragging about it, it's like that Calvin and Hobbes is, you know, Calvin's bragging to Susie, you know. Einstein failed math, I did even worse. You know, it's that kind of mentality. Okay, so if you're failing, so all of a sudden you denigrate wisdom. But if the wisest of all men is saying that wisdom causes heartache, you've got to take that a little seriously. So Sforno reinterprets the pasuk. He doesn't just reinterpret it. He's radically reinterpreting the pasuk. Meaning, I can tell you he's reinterpreting the pasuk. Right? I just look at it and I say, this is not a fair alternative to what most of our Mefarshim say, which is what I told you a minute ago. Namely, Kohelet is describing his own wisdom and the whole process. He's not describing the wisdom of heretics at all. The question that I always end up lingering with, I have no answers for you, is, did Sforno himself think the pasuk must mean this, because it cannot possibly mean that Kohelet is denigrating wisdom in any form? Or did Sforno know full well what the pasuk means, but he was afraid as a religious educator that if he said that, somebody's going to read it and say, okay, who needs wisdom? It causes heartache. And therefore, condemn heresy, good thing to do in all cases, and then we can move on. I'm not sure what Kohelet thought when he wrote a comment like that, and I'm not sure time and again when you see these things. So that's strategy number one, and you see lots of this, like really, 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 really lots of this. When Mefarshim are saying things that are not, there's always machloket, that's fine. It's not that I know exactly what the pasuk means, and if a parshan says something, you know, that was Nechama Leibowitz's line, what's pshat and what's drash? What she thinks is pshat, and what you think is drash. Like that was her methodology, and she said it tongue-in-cheek, but she kind of meant it. Right? In other words, she did have a command of pshat, because she was, after all, Nechama Leibowitz, and she was such a phenomenal expert, she had a serious command of what she was talking about. But Mefarshim argue all the time. That's our bread and butter. That's what we do. We spend time sorting through Machloket, and Machloket doesn't often have a clear-cut winner. That's fine. I'm talking about here radical reinterpretation, where a pasuk almost for sure is not saying what a parshan is saying. And why is he doing it? Visibly because he is concerned with hashkafic ramifications of the pasuk, the way that it reads. Okay, so that's strategy number one, and you see a lot of that in Kohelet. What about poor Ibn Ezra? He doesn't like that thing. He doesn't like radical reinterpretation. In fact, it really, really bothers him, and he rails against it when he sees other Mefarshim doing that. It really bothers him when somebody has a pasuk in front of him and reinterprets it to such an extent that Ibn Ezra says, that's just not what it means. I'm sorry. We can disagree. We can have different approaches and valid readings. That's fine. And of course, Ibn Ezra thinks that he's right, but at least he respects other valid alternatives. But he doesn't like radical reinterpretation. And he doesn't like to do it himself. But you know what? He's also bothered by a lot of psukim in Kohelet. So what does he do? So he has his own strategy. Like, for example, he's bothered by, you don't need to be bothered by this, but he sure is. In source number 7, Kohelet, after confronting the inevitability of death, which is one of the running themes of the Sefer, says later on, in more upbeat mood, go eat your bread in happiness. God wants you to enjoy this worldly benefit while you can. Likewise, wear clean clothing, you should, you know, have, put oil in your hair, it's a good luxury. And you should enjoy being with your spouse all of your days of your hevel. Your fleeting life. You could read these as tremendously life-affirming psukim. That's how I read them. It seems very much that that's what he's doing here. He's saying that I'm not going to solve death, but I can tell you how to make the most of life while we're here. That's one of the most important things that Kohelet tries to do. Ibn Ezra doesn't like this as a conclusion to, if we're going to die, what should we do? So he says, in source number 8, what is a classic Ibn Ezra-esque strategy here. This is what people think who are foolish. What's Kohelet doing? Kohelet's not speaking for himself here, he's quoting what morons think. And Ibn Ezra does that often in Tanakh, when he is confronted with psukim that he is genuinely bothered by. But it sounds like, in this case, Kohelet is speaking, or a Mishorer and Tehillim is speaking, whoever it is, but he doesn't like it. He will impose an artificial speaker. He'll say, this prophetically inspired speaker is quoting somebody else. And that, of course, absolves him of the difficulty of the pasuk. If he's quoting what fools think, okay, this is the view of fools. It's not the view of Shlomo HaMelech writing Ruach HaKodesh. That's the upside. It solves the problem with that radical reinterpretation. The downside, there ain't no speaker here. Right? It doesn't sound in the least like he's quoting somebody else. It sounds like he's quoting himself because he's speaking. Biblical writers know how to quote other people when they need to, and when they don't, that means that they probably are not. And Arayom HaZeh, there are still writers to this day who try to solve the difficulties of Kohelet by imposing different speakers. This is the voice of the Chacham, and this is the voice of the heretic, and this is the voice of the fool, and this is the voice of the simple pious person, and this, that, and the other thing. I find that incredibly unpersuasive just because the book don't say so. Right? It's really that simple. If you're going to look from the text outward, when you start saying, oh, this belongs to this speaker and that belongs to that speaker, what you're really saying is, I'm in charge of saying what things are hashkafically fine and what things are not hashkafically fine, right? As opposed to if you're a Pashtun looking from the text outward, what you're supposed to say is, well, what is the text teaching? And that's the hazard of the imposition of speakers. That's Ibn Ezra's classical strategy which he uses here. For the record, Ibn Ezra did this in the 12th century. Wherever there were bothersome to him, psukim, he just said, oh, it belongs to somebody else. He's quoting somebody else. In the 19th century, secular scholarship reversed the trend, but they did the same trick. They thought, all these secular scholars in the 19th century who were, for the most part, very anti-Jewish, let alone anti-Judaism, not all of them, but a lot of them sure were, their standard party line for a while was, Kohelet actually himself was a heretic, and then an Orthodox glossator came in and frumified the book. So in other words, they do the exact opposite of what Ibn Ezra is doing, right? In other words, they're saying, real Kohelet actually was rebelling against the Torah, but since it was, you know, attributed to Shlomo HaMelech, and since it, you know, was in Tanakh already, so they tried to fix it up. Just to give you the example from what we looked at before, they would have told you, and in fact that's what they were saying in source number 4, real Kohelet just said the first half of source number 4. He said, go out there and party, young folk. And then the Orthodox glossator came in and said, but know that God is going to judge you. Okay, so that's just putting the problem in reverse, it's equally arbitrary and it's equally, to my mind, false to the spirit of the book. I mean, it's amazing that you see just the flip side of what Ibn Ezra was trying to do, but it simply does not work if you're trying to work from the text outward. That's yet another strategy that, in my opinion, is doomed to fail. There's one other strategy that many Mefarshim use from time immemorial, and that has to do with contradictions. There are a lot of verses that seem to contradict themselves in Kohelet. That's what Chazal mentioned in passing. Ibn Ezra goes on a lengthy discussion of this in source number 9. Well, source number 9 is just 3 lines long, but if I actually gave you all of what Ibn Ezra said on Pasuk Gimel, it is big. Right, so I'm just giving you the 3 lines that are his premise, and then you can look at what he has to say about it inside. It's a lot more than 3 lines. In one place he says one thing, in one place he says the opposite. Chazal themselves were willing to almost ban the book because they feared its contradictions. Even an intellectual lightweight doesn't write a book and contradict himself, let alone Kohelet. And therefore Ibn Ezra developed a whole battery of strategies for how to answer these contradictions. That's not just him. A lot of Mefarshim follow suit because the contradictions are there and you got to sort it out. Rav Soloveitchik and later on Rav Shalom Carmi and Dr. David Schatz, I'm not going to read these, you know, we could all read English together on our own time, but you have them for you, insist that Ibn Ezra's premise is wrong. Without picking on Ibn Ezra per se, they're picking on the history of Parshanut, who made this fundamental mistake. Ibn Ezra's mistake is that he was using a Greek premise that an author will not contradict himself, at least not an intelligent one. But Judaism, argued the Rav and argue in his footsteps, Rabbi Shalom Carmi and Dr. David Schatz, always had a dialectical tradition. Contradictions are part and parcel of the tradition. In fact, Rabbi Carmi and Dr. Schatz in the excerpt that I give you, use Kohelet as a prime example to show how Judaism uses contradictions rather than is afraid of them or rather doesn't have them. It's a whole different approach. But Ibn Ezra, following many other Mefarshim follow suit, spend a lot of time trying to reconcile contradictions. And if you read their solutions, sometimes you might be convinced, sometimes you might not be convinced, but I'll tell you one thing. When you have lots and lots and lots of contradictions, even if you solve every single one to your satisfaction, you've got to at least ask the question, how come there are so many seeming contradictions that we need to fix? Right? Maybe the reason why we're struggling here is because we didn't ask that question. If we just say, oh no, contradiction, let's fix it, that's one approach. If we say, it's a very small book and yet there are all kinds of contradictions, maybe something else is going on, well, that opens up all kinds of different doors, and I find that a much more productive way to do it. So let's summarize what we've had so far. Okay, good. What we've had so far is strategies dealing with the hazards of Kohelet. Chazal even considered banning it, but that didn't happen. They decided it was from enough to include. So good. Baruch Hashem, I'm glad that they included it. Mefarshim, who don't have the option of banishing it, engage in widespread radical reinterpretation. In the case of Ibn Ezra and a few others, you have this attribution to other voices. And then you have all kinds of mechanical resolutions to contradictions that seem to be there. The best way to go about Pshat, in my opinion, and again, I'm not making any of this up. A lot of our Mefarshim, a lot of the time, do all of the things that I'm going to outline. But those other things happen so often, I felt it was important to mention them at length because it really explains what everybody is nervous about. And then we could start zoning in on what makes Kohelet so special, which is, of course, what you do when you have one shiur to talk about it. I like statistics. It goes back to my baseball fan days, you should know. Today happens to be the 27th anniversary of the Mets winning Game 7, and I was there. That was one of the highlights of my childhood. It was a phenomenal October 27th, I didn't have to study for the history midterm either. It was like all the good stuff. But in the meantime, so back to my baseball fan days, which were important back in the day, I like statistics because I think most Jewish baseball fans tend to really, really like statistics. I don't know why, it just happens that way. It works with Tanakh too. And if you start paying attention to biblical statistics, you start finding out that the data help us understand all kinds of important things. For example, there's an expression that appears a lot of times in Kohelet, Takara Shemesh. In fact, 29 times if you sit there counting them. Takara Shemesh refers to this worldly existence. In the other 23 books of Tanakh combined, the expression Takara Shemesh appears 0 times. That's a good statistic. That's pretty amazing, actually. That Kohelet is clearly defining a different playing field. They even refer to Tachat HaShemayim appears 3 more times, also nowhere else. People are even called Ro'e HaShemesh, people who see the sun. It's very clear that Kohelet is talking about this worldly existence and this worldly meaning. Another thing, you know, when I was in first grade, we spent a lot of time with like Ani Amarti type conjugations, right? Don't get me started. But in the meantime, and we just learned Ani Amarti and all that kind of stuff, Ata Amarta, blah, 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 blah. Biblical Hebrew, actually, you wouldn't say Ani Amarti, right? What would you say? You just say Amarti. It does the job. Kohelet uses Ani, like Ani Amarti type expressions a lot. He sounds like a first grader to us, you know, American first grader no less, right? He has all these Anis. Now, it's not because he didn't know Hebrew or he was speaking like a little kid. The difference in biblical Hebrew between Amarti and Ani Amarti is Amarti means I said, or I say, whatever. I mean, there's no past, present, future the way that there is in modern Hebrew. But fine. I said. And Ani Amarti means I said. Right? In other words, you're emphasizing yourself. Kohelet is very much a personal reflection. Okay, so that's another thing that makes his book stand out from everything else. In fact, Kohelet is by far the most human perspective sefer in Tanakh. Not only is there nothing about prophecy, forget about that, but the reality that he describes is the reality that you and I see. If we were standing next to Yechezkel, by the way, how cool would that be? But we would not see what he saw. Right? We would see him in a prophetic, we'd see him in experiencing some unbelievable prophetic experience, and he would see the Merkava. If we were standing next to Kohelet, incidentally, also a very cool place to be, we would see exactly the realities that he sees, with no exception. Any thoughtful, intelligent person standing with Kohelet would see exactly the reality that he sees. So much so that there's one minority opinion in among the Tanaim in a Tosefta, source number 12, Rabbi Shimon ben Menasya Omer, Shira Shirim Etame'a Tayadayim Mepneish Me'emra Beruach HaKodesh, the Kohelet Eina Metame'a Tayadayim, it's not Ruach HaKodesh, it's just King Solomon's wisdom. Now, our tradition accepts that it is written Ruach HaKodesh, but the fact that you can have a Tana saying that it's not, all is rooted in the fact that, yeah, any wise human being, I mean, we wouldn't write it as well. We wouldn't write it with the oomph that Shlomo HaMelech could write it with, and we certainly wouldn't have the credibility, because we're not the wisest or the wealthiest. But you know what? We could have written this book. We could not have written any other biblical book the same way. That's why Rabbi Shimon ben Menasya said what he was able to say. Here's another statistic. Statistics are great. It's such a good transfer from like batting averages and stuff. This is so much more useful also sometimes. But in the meantime, the term Adam appears in Kohelet 49 times. 48 of those times it means humankind, and one time it actually does mean male people in contrast to female people, okay? But there's nothing about Jews, Israel, there's nothing about Torah, there's nothing about a covenant, there's nothing about prophecy at all. It's all about humanity, Chochmah, and Yirat Shamayim, Yirat Elohim more precisely. Here's another interesting statistic. The only biblical book that does not have God's name is Megillat Esther, except for the other biblical book that also doesn't have God's name, which is Shir HaShirim. Right? There are two biblical books that don't have any of God's names in them. And Kohelet has Elohim 40 times and Yudkei Vavkei 0 times. It's the only book like that. That's interesting, because Yudkei Vavkei and Elohim are not just two names of God. Elohim is the transcendent creator God. It's not even a name, it's a noun. As opposed to Yudkei Vavkei, imminent. We talk to Yudkei Vavkei, we can pray to Yudkei Vavkei, and it's God's name. It's a very personal aspect of the relationship. So Elohim creates the cosmos, but you and I pray to Yudkei Vavkei. At least the way Tanakh manifests them. Well, if Kohelet is talking exclusively about Elohim, that means that it's the universal God, but it also means one who's very, very far away. Kohelet actually never prays to God and can't. Kohelet talks about God. That's all he's able to do. He can talk about prayer, but he can't pray. Because if God is very far away and distant, and Elohim, there's no personal connection over there. Kohelet is able to say something like source number 13, don't be so brash or hasty before God. Pray and be brash very little, because God is all the way up there and you're all the way down there. So who do you think you are to pick a fight with God? I imagine that he's talking to Eo. Now, if he went to Eov's house, he put his arm around Eov. Well, no, he wouldn't, because Eov was covered in boils. But in the meantime, but he would come to Eov, and he would not be like the friends. He'd say, these friends don't know what they're talking about. Your suffering, Eov, is hevel. It is absolutely incomprehensible. I can't understand Tzadik v'Ra, although I lose sleep over it myself. I talk about it in my own book. But don't start yelling at God, because who do you think you are? Eov is speaking to Yodkei Vavke. He has a relationship, and that's his whole struggle. That's what we spoke about last week. For Kohelet, it's all a distant thing. He's just saying, I'm reflecting on the situation. You're crazy. You're yelling at God. What do you think you're going to achieve from that? God is way powerful, and you're way not. You're going to lose. Nitziv was able to make an anachronistic minhag comment on this, which is brilliant. It really encapsulates the nature of Kohelet very, very well. Khatab Sefer Zechariah Yudalit in source number 14, Dilatid Yu Gamu Mota Ulam Ba'im Bechola Moed Sukkot La Mod Al Korbanam. The Kacha Yamin Hagbi Meshlamo, Mishum Hachi Ayashlamo Magid Kohelet Bechola Moed Sukkot Lev Nechach Meir Mota Ulam. The Tzif surmises that why do we, that is those of us who read Kohelet on Sukkot, why do we read Kohelet on Sukkot? Because Shlomo HaMelech himself recited Kohelet on Sukkot. Why? Because non-Jews were there. And this book is addressed equally to Jews and non-Jews who are Yirei Shamayim. It was the most universalistic of the holidays. And Nitziv is exactly spot on in terms of what the book is about. And Mishum Hachi, Lo Nizkar Ba'Ki'im Shem Elokim. He explains that's why it's just Elokim here. The universal God. Mishum Di'inu Lo Yadei Elezeh Hashem. Non-Jews don't have that personal Yivke Ba'Ki connection. That's Israel. That's our way of relating to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So Kohelet, speaking to Yirei Shamayim in general, uses the shem Elohim. It's a very powerful way of describing why Kohelet is so different. Kohelet is so different because he's not speaking through prophecy or received wisdom. He's speaking, I have received wisdom, but now I'm looking with my own two eyes and they are open. And when I look around, I can't help but notice that the stuff that they taught me isn't always what happened. Mishle, when that happens, we talked about this 2 weeks ago, Mishle also sees conflict. He says, well, you just have to interpret reality through the lens of wisdom. Kohelet says, I can't do that. For Kohelet, there's received wisdom and it's what I see, and they're both true. And there's a conflict all the time between those two things. And that's what Hevel is. Hevel is when there's a clash between what I thought was supposed to happen and what happens, and what I see with my two eyes. I'm not going to let wisdom color what I see. I'm also not going to say, since I see this, I'm leaving wisdom. He very much holds on to wisdom and continues and perpetually holds on to it as the supreme value. He never gives up on wisdom. He never gives up on what he was taught. He just says, I'm not going to force that teaching onto what I see, but I'm also not going to force what I see onto wisdom. And that's why there's so much Hevel in the book. That's why he's so tormented, because there are conflicts between what we are taught and what we see. And he holds it up both. Another example of how a purely human perspective changes things. If you have a purely human perspective and look at oppression, what do? Source number 15. The Shaptiani Ve'er'eh Kol Ashukim Asher Na'asim Tachal Hashamesh. I look and see all the oppression under the sun. V'nei Dimat Ashukim. People are crying with the oppression. Nobody's even comforting them. It's better to be dead than to have to witness this terrible oppression. And even better than the dead person is somebody who was never alive in the first place. You read this to him, you get really depressed, right? You should. From a purely human perspective, that's what you see. History is a cycle, and every generation, just read any history book, or lots of them, and you see more and more how much oppression there is, and you see how nobody seems to fix that. Well, from a purely human perspective, that's where it goes. Let's say Yeshayahu saw oppression. What would he do? Well, what does he do? He sees plenty of oppression, and he doesn't just say, oh, it's better to be dead. What does Nivuah do when it sees oppression? It says, guys, stop oppressing, right? And not only that, but kings and governments, let's try to make better laws and uphold them so that there's no oppression in our society. No Navi is ever going to rest as long as anything is imperfect, which happens to be what is always has been, but Nevi'im will never rest until we do something about that. We can always improve our society. Nevi'im never say, oh, this is just the way that it is, Hevel, and this is a cycle, and nature goes through cycles, and people go through cycles, and there's always oppression, and it's depressing, and it's better just never to have to live for it. Nevi'im don't tolerate that. Nevi'im are fired up and say, we got to do something about it. What would Abraham Avinu do if he saw oppression? He would look God in the eye and say, God, let's do something about this. Right? Nevuah doesn't just take these things sitting down. What Kohelet does is it isolates the human variable, which no other biblical book does. Biblical books are all mixtures of the divine perspective and the human perspective, different levels, right? Torah being the most divine, Yechezkel being very, very, very divine, and others being closer to the human end with Esther towards the bottom of that spectrum, right? Kohelet is a purely human perspective. It's what the world looks like if there's no prophecy. And it's very depressing, by the way. If there's no prophecy, if there's nothing beyond us, if it's just what we see with our own eyes, it can be very sad. It's also full of contradictions. Human reality is not all so smooth and without contradiction. It's hardly surprising that Sefer Kohelet is filled with contradictions. He's describing human reality. Any of us, writing about our own lives or anybody else who we know, would always find contradictions and different facets of the same issue. Why? Because life is complicated. It is hardly surprising that Kohelet has all kinds of paradoxes and contradictions. So rather than trying to solve them, Adrava, the whole point is that they're there because he's writing from a purely human perspective. So Kohelet is kind of funny because Tanakh, after all, mostly is revelation. Right? The whole point of our religion is that it is a revealed religion. God revealed the Torah and God revealed Nevuah, and that's what makes Judaism, Judaism. You don't have, there is no Judaism without revelation, right? So what's Kohelet doing there? See, that's why Chazal and Meir Mefarshim were so worried about it. Because it's a purely human perspective, and a purely human perspective contradicts things that you would see from a transcendent perspective. And it contradicts the messages of the Nevi'im. And it contradicts things that you find in the Torah. And that's why there was so much fear, which led to all kinds of strategies for reinterpretation. But what the existence of Kohelet on the pshat level is doing something else. It's saying human perception is not the whole story. You need the other 23 books, and in fact, without the other 23 books, Kohelet doesn't do you any good at all. But the human perception is necessary and it's sacred. It was included in Tanakh. It was a very bold thing for Chazal to include. But by including it, they're saying that what we see with our own eyes is sacred. It's part of truth with a big capital T. Right? So much so that Chazal come up with one of these amazing, amazing midrashim that you can't believe it till you see it. I know it's coming up. I'd have read it before. And I still can't believe it's coming up. The pasuk, it's already in the appendix part of Sefer Kohelet, all the way at the end of the Sefer, Vyoter, source number 16. Shaya Kohelet Chacham Od, Lima Dadet Ha'am, V'Izein V'Chiker, Tikei Mishalim Arbe. Okay, so Kohelet was a great sage, and Izein V'Chiker, what's Izein? He listened, that's the receiving part of him, and what's Chiker? That's the challenging part, right? In other words, Kohelet did both of these things. He teaches us, that's why he's such an amazing model. He teaches us how to completely hold on to our received tradition and simultaneously to have a completely critical mind. He never lets go of either side of that. It's a very difficult thing to do. That's exactly what the point of Kohelet is. And Chazal then come up with this remarkable statement that I just made a fuss about, so let's actually read it. V'yoter shayah Kohelet Chacham, source number 17. Od limad dat et ha'am v'izein v'chiker tiken mishalim harbe. V'izein divrei Torah. Izein means he listened to them. V'chiker divrei Torah asa was na'im l'Torah. So they're darshaning it to mean he made handles or ears for the Torah. What does that mean? Rav Nachman tartein, Rav Nachman amar l'paltin g'dolah shayu ba p'tachim harbe. Once upon a time there was a palace with many, many, many doorways. And alas, people like me with terrible senses of direction would get in there and would be hopelessly lost and unable to get out until a genius came along and invented the exit sign. And that's what the next line says. Bapi Kiafahad, a genius came. He made an exit sign. Now everybody went to the exit sign and got out of the palace. Ha, here's the amazing part. Ad Shlomo Amad Shlomo, until Shlomo came, Lo Haya Adam Yachol Lehastil Divrei Torah. Nobody understood the Torah. What? Nobody? Shmuel HaNavi didn't understand the Torah. Are you kidding me? David HaMelech didn't understand the Torah. Shaul HaMelech, all these people, we had some amazing people before, between Moshe Rabbeinu and Shlomo HaMelech. And your Chazal are saying that for 400 years, nobody understood the Torah. Are you kidding me? And what did Shlomo do to change that? He made an exit sign. It was too confusing for most people. He was able to lead us in some kind of direction to give us a path to be able to figure it out. I think that Shetoshel Midrasho here is saying something very powerful. Of course Shmuel HaNavi understood the Torah because he was a Navi himself. In an age of prophecy, a Navi can tell us, when it said by Daber Hashem al Moshe Limor, you and I just know, however it happened, God communicated to Moshe Rabbeinu. But a Navi would have a much better sense of what that means. Not a Moshe Rabbeinu level sense, but a much better sense than you and I have. And they would understand it. But how about us regular folk who are not Naviim? Well, we read it, we love it, we're totally moved by it, and we live our lives according to it. But we really don't know what it means at all. Until Kohelet came along, until Shlomo HaMelech came along and said, love God, wow, that's a really big concept. It sounds so wondrous. We say it in the Shema all the time. How in the world do you do that? And Shlomo says, you know what? I'm going to talk about the love between a man and a woman. Because more people understand that one. And if they understand what deep human love is about, they can begin to talk about what it means to love God. Wow! What a great use of Shir HaShirim. It propels us into some understanding, some taste of what it might mean to love God. And same thing with Kohelet. We're hearing teaching after teaching after teaching from Nevuah, and we accept it, but then we look with our own eyes and we don't always see a reality that matches that. So Mishle's solution is, we have to be better Chachamim. We have to be able to reinterpret reality. Kohelet says, no, you can keep your human perspective and hold on to your Chokhmah. And you don't know the answers to these. Hevel, you're going to be frustrated if you try to solve all these paradoxes. Well, that gives people a chance to understand the Torah by saying that we don't understand everything that's in the Torah. It gives us a maturity and humility to realize we don't understand the Nevuah fully, even though we live our lives in accordance with it. So let's wrap it all up. What I tried to show in this overview of Kohelet is, first of all, trying to reconcile Kohelet with the other 23 books of Tanakh is doomed to failure for a very good reason. Kohelet is simply not like the other books. There's a reason why everybody found it so different, because it is. Most importantly, Kohelet teaches that the human voice and perception is sacred, that it's part and parcel of what Tanakh is all about, and its inclusion into Tanakh makes our perception sacred, even though, of course, it's not the only perception. We still have the prophetic perception, which we need to transcend ourselves. If we only have Elohim, we can't pray. If we only see our reality, we're going to see oppression and get depressed. We're never going to try to fix it. We're never going to say we have a messianic goal that we can march towards or work towards, because there's more to it than what we see with our own eyes. Chazal are right. Kohelet is a very dangerous book, because allowing people to think is dangerous. But they concluded that excluding it from Tanakh was more dangerous. If it were not part of Tanakh, so many people would look at the world and not have a voice within Tanakh saying what we see. And all of a sudden, we'd either have to reinterpret our reality to wisdom, which is what Mishlei advocates, or we'd be in a lot of trouble. Right? Because suddenly we would see something and it wouldn't match what we're supposed to be seeing, and we'd get very confused. Kohelet opens up that door, and Chazal ultimately decided it's better to have it in there as part of our religion than not to have it in there. The process, by the way, does not mean that you're a happier person. Wisdom can be very frustrating and filled with contradictions and vexation and all of those things, and that's what Kohelet is trying to say. But Kohelet, by being part of the tapestry of the wonderful complex of Sfarim that we call Tanakh, teaches us the humility to realize that yes, we believe in Nevuah, and yes, our whole life is guided by Nevuah, but simultaneously, since we're not Nevi'im, and we see through a human lens, it's important to give us guidance in how to take that human lens and sanctify it, to show that actually we can approach HaKadosh Baruch Hu on our own terms and then transcend ourselves by going to the realms of Nevuah. So I'm very grateful that Chazal decided to keep it in there, because obviously the power of the Sefer is overwhelming. When you read the pain of Shlomo HaMelech trying to reckon with how do you hold on to both, he teaches us a method of exactly how to go about doing that. And that's something which, of course, is something which it's not just for adults. I think once a kid is like 7th grade and up, or whatever number you want to put on that, suddenly that's a mechanism that we really need to be teaching our children and our adults, being able to think very intelligently and critically about what we see, and simultaneously to develop as greater Yerushalayim through that critical thinking. So with that, I wanted to take the opportunity to thank you all. Well, time for a little bit of Q&A, but I wanted to thank you all for this three-part series. It meant a lot to me to come out, you know, for a three-part series to discuss three totally different perspectives of biblical wisdom with you, and at least in an overview sort of form. I'm deeply grateful to Rabbi Hochberg and to Avi Feller for putting it all together, for the invitation, and I thank the sponsors for making it all possible. You know, the rabbi said, you know, it's not your main thing, but the fact of the matter is, rabbis and education chairs always want to give their communities the best Torah possible, and the sponsors really make that a possibility. So I'm grateful to all of them, whether I know who you are or not, or even who the names are who were mentioned or not. I also want to thank the Institute for Jewish Ideas and Ideals, which makes it really all possible. I mean, I've switched from the rabbinate to full-time education, so I'm able to actually come here and do that. I'm grateful to the members of the Institute who are out there, and if you want to join, it's very easy to do so. You can help support this sort of learning throughout the country, which is what I'm basically doing, hopefully, for the next many, many, many years until I finally decide to retire. Rabbis never retire. They just kind of morph. So that's basically, you know, to basically find a way of teaching, because I think there's a great thirst for this kind of learning all over the place. And I'm very grateful that there's such a great thirst in the community of young Israel to make us safe. So with that, I thank you very much, and I'll take a couple of questions.
Two questions. You mentioned the talk of the Shalom occurred so many times in this book, and not many other books. So what is the message about the talk of the Shalom? And in the difficulty of seeing the real world and being depressed, and yet somehow reconciling that there's something beautiful and better. You only mentioned the possibility that people can get up and try to change things. Is there any other way of reconciling all the bad things we see with the ahava, the beauty that we're supposed to feel because of the total learning?
Well, that's already part of the same thing. Meaning, if you just had a Kohelet world, you would be a very depressed individual. And that's, you know, if you just read Kohelet, if that were the only sefer in Tanakh, you would say there's oppression, it always is there, and it's miserable. Better never to have been born. Okay. But when you have the other 23 Sfarim, which are talking about there's something bigger than what you see, and there's a world that isn't here now, but that we can make, that's what gives us hope. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks has a wonderful distinction between optimism and hope. Optimism is very often false, where, you know, things are crummy, but, oh, I hope and dream that things will be better. Like, you know, right now my daughters are 2.5, so you cannot believe what an expert I am now in Disney princesses, right? Holy moly. I know the songs, I know, I'll go on about it some other time. In the meantime, it's all about this magical hope, right, that some fairy godmother is going to show up, and it's nice and optimistic, but usually in real world, those fairy godmothers just don't show up like that. Hope is about, it's something real. Hope doesn't mean, oh, I pretend that things will be different. Hope means that we actually have a vision that we can march toward. It's not an easy road, but I think it's a far more realistic and sobering way of looking at the Jewish perception of hope, which is what the Nevi'im are trying to teach. So to answer your question, we need Nivuah, or we'd never transcend ourselves. Tachar HaShemesh is just the Kohelet perspective, which is no Nivuah, right? I mean, he's just focused on this worldly existence without anything that's transcendent.
If Kohelet is not Nivuah, it's separate what is the what qualifies it as Ruach HaKodesh? How does that
It's just the way our tradition understands meaning. It belongs in sacred literature. It's not the same thing as Rambam writing the Moreh Nevuchim, for example. In other words, you have other wise sages who have written wisdom, but Kohelet stands as the objective stamp of truth, meaning you can disagree with Rambam. You can't disagree with Kohelet. You can interpret, and boy oh boy, our Mefarshim do, but once it's in Tanakh, you're not allowed to, the rules of the game are you cannot disagree with it because it's truth. You can disagree with what that truth means. But that's a whole that's what makes it different. So Ruach HaKodesh means that it stands above rebuke and critique, even if we can debate what it means. Yeah. Yeah.
Comment on the beginning of Kohelet that the tone is sort of changed and comes to the conclusion that you know, when the book you know, that sort of doesn't go with the tone of the book.
Right, so I actually believe, I mean, here's where you need the 9-week version as opposed to the 1-hour version. I think that Sof Davar Kol Nishma Pasuk is exactly what the whole book was saying. Exactly. In other words, we serve God, we fear God, and the whole book is about the fear of God. And his struggles are through coming to terms with the humility that's required to fear God. I don't think that that verse saves the book or changes anything that happened in the book. Again, we would need the 9-week version to go verse by verse to show how the whole thing is rooted in that. But yeah, I think that's, it's just an excellent synopsis. Meaning if you walked away from Qohelet not thinking that that was his point, you read something wrong. All right, on that happy note. By the way, just one last point on that last comment, and then you can clap all you want. We'll make sure to still get that on the audio. But before we do that, Rashbam actually thinks that those last verses were not even written by Shlomo. It was written by the later editors of the book. Right, and later Mefarshim follows suit just based on a literary inclusio. Again, it takes us a lot of time to get through that. He doesn't think that it matters that those verses were written later because it doesn't change the message of the book. It simply encapsulates what the book is doing. And I think that is right. On that happy note, I once again thank you all for taking the time to come out.
Again, great thanks to our angel. Special thanks to Ali Baylor, who went back and forth, trying to make sure that all this happened. We don't necessarily always appreciate everything that goes into making sure we have things like this. We thank the sponsors again. November 17th, our angel will be back. And